Thank you. I'd like to welcome the steering committee members to our work group C conference call for this evening. And Melinda is going to give us an overview of the meeting goals for the call.
Thanks, Alexis. The meeting was set up as a result of a request from steering committee members during the orientation call. And what we hope to achieve on the call is to have you have the opportunity to talk through the ratings that were set for the measures by the work group, and talk them through in terms of any concerns, any specific discussion or points that you want to raise, with the objective being that at the end of the call, you have a common understanding and feeling and thought about the approach to the presentation of the measures at the steering committee meeting. A couple of things probably before we start is to know who else is on the call. Harriet Gammon, I think you're on the call with us.
Yes, that's correct.
And Harriet is representing the Joint Commission on the call. And is there anyone from ARC on the call?
This is Ann Watt. I am not from ARC. I am from the Commission.
I'm sorry, Ann, you're from where?
The Joint Commission. I work with Harriet.
Okay. Nice to have you.
Thank
Can
you.
I have someone else's voice?
This is Cheryl Davies. I'm on the I'm at Stanford University and part of the ARC QI development team.
Very good. Thank you for joining us. For those of you who represent the developers, what we are doing today is affording a small group of the steering committee who were particularly charged with an in-depth analysis and evaluation of measures to have an opportunity to talk about that those measures together prior to going to the steering committee, at which time there will be the focused discussion on the measures and an opportunity for interaction between the developers and the steering committee members. There's no expectation today for any presentation from the developers or for the developers to be asked to respond to any specific questions. It's really focused on allowing the group to have a conversation together about the measures they've evaluated. And so that's really the overarching goal for the meeting. If there's anyone in the group from the steering committee who would like to achieve something additional in the time we have, if you'll just mention that now, we'll try to be certain we do whatever else it is you'd like to do during the time. Okay, if you decide later you want to add something, please feel free to do so. In the measures that you see on your agenda, there are two that are measures that are endorsed and are being reviewed through the maintenance cycle, and that's the first two. Those are the ARC measures, and the remainder of the measures are new candidate measures that have been submitted by the Joint Commission. Those of you who are identified to present the measures should expect that you will also be presenting or introducing the measure at the steering committee meeting on the 28th of February. So if everybody's comfortable with doing so, we can go ahead and start a discussion about the measures at this point. Two things I guess I would like to say first. One is that if you have not referred back to the documents that were sent to you for the orientation session, at some point you might want to pull that back out and look particularly from pages 11 forward through 16, because it's got detailed information about the measure evaluation criteria with footnotes and with the addition of some specifics that we are asking that be evaluated during the review of measures that are undergoing maintenance. So that said, if Dr. Sipperstein, you want to lead off with introduction and an overview of the evaluations of Measure 360, that would be terrific.
Perfect. Yeah, no, I can do that. Hi, Alan Sipperstein here, for those I haven't met. And obviously this is inexorably linked to the next measure as well. The first measure looks at mortality after esophageal surgery for cancer, and the second measure, to jump ahead a little bit, looks at hospital volume for each of those measures. As everyone's aware, esophageal surgery for cancer is a fairly high-risk procedure. Part of that has to do with the underlying patient morbidity. These are often more elderly patients, smoking history, concomitant lung and cardiovascular disease. The operations themselves are typically in two or three different body cavities, so neck, chest, and abdomen, and all of those factors lead to a high morbidity and mortality. This has been one of the prototype procedures that has been studied in the literature correlating hospital volume with outcomes. And I think this is the kind of the key crux of this measure. So it is a relatively low volume procedure, but a relatively high morbidity and mortality procedure. I think one of the rationales of following something like this is it is obviously a surrogate for other high-risk procedures. So measures that are put in place within a hospital for this type of procedure are obviously transferable to other procedures as well. One of my kind of subtle, questions in terms of, you know, how the measure has been playing out is that the metric used for mortality, and correct me if I've misinterpreted this, has to do with the number of deaths during the index hospitalization. Many of our other mortality figures are done with 30-day mortality. It has the theoretic potential, but I don't know practically whether it could possibly throw off that in terms of patients being discharged from the hospital and then readmitted or then having problems or being transferred to other hospitals in terms of how the measure is really accurately captured. But I would say in most situations that's not going to be a methodologic flaw in the way this is done. So those are some of my summary comments. I mean, the metric is very easy, very, very straightforward, very clean set of CPT codes to track, and obviously an endpoint of mortality is straightforward, for better or for worse.
Okay, so then do you want to look across the criteria in terms of similarities or differences in the way in which people have evaluated and to afford everyone an opportunity to particularly comment if there's some area of concern or disagreement that you have?
Well, I think, you know, looking at the table, there is pretty uniform agreement across in terms of, each of the measures, each of the subcomponents meeting, you know, scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not a big disparate or any real outliers in terms of any of those measures.
So anyone else in the group have a comment? And I guess I would ask, go ahead. I'm sorry. Someone's going to say something. Okay, so then if I hear correctly what you said and the quietness of the rest of the group, is it safe to assume that you feel that it meets all of the criteria, that this measure meets all of the criteria?
Actually, this is Arden Morris. I have a couple of issues for discussion with regard to this measure. First of all, I'm a little bit concerned about the low-volume centers and the accuracy of mortality in those centers. For example, if a center does one operation in a year and the patient doesn't die, does that mean they have 100% survival? And, you know, for the ensuing 9 years, they might have 0% survival if they do one operation a year in the following 9 years. So I'm a little bit worried about that. And I, related to that, in area 2C validity testing, the signal-to-noise ratio is quoted as 0.26, which means that there's about 3.5 times more noise than there is signal with this measure. So I'm a little bit about worried about mortality assessment in low-volume hospitals. I think in high-volume hospitals, it's probably very useful.
I think what Alan Zipperstein here. I mean, obviously, you know, as you pointed out, in a low-volume center, your confidence intervals are going to be very wide.
Very wide.
It has to be taken into account. I think one of the lessons is more global in terms of if you aggregate a large number of low-volume centers versus aggregating high-volume centers, is this where the lesson is coming out? In terms of a lesson to patients, in terms of choosing where to get their care, or insurance providers, in terms of where to direct their patients to get care.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. I would say the only sort of finer point in there is if we're applying measures that will be looked at for individual hospitals, if the public, for example, is looking at an individual hospital, they won't have the opportunity to necessarily aggregate. Definitely if hospitals are taken in aggregate and measured in aggregate, I think that this would be very useful and for low volume as well as medium and high volume. So in terms of how this measure would be used, would it be used at the aggregate level or would it be used at the individual hospital level? Do we know that from ARC?
And the individual who's online from ARC may or may not have that information simply because we did not ask that they had their experts on.
Absolutely. But it's just kind of a heads up about some of the issues.
Great. And thank you for saying that because one of the things that the measure developer representatives may want to do is keep some notes of the discussion so that they are best prepared to address questions at the meeting.
That's really my major item on this.
So then, it's Melinda. Is the group comfortable to proceed to the next one with a sense of you know where you're going with the discussion of this measure at the steering committee? Yes.
Yes, Carpenter, I think so. I think that's a good point about the low-volume centers, and we'll get into, I guess, discussion with the next metric about how they may work together or
right.
not. But I think those are good. Everything that's raised has been good points.
Yeah, and I wonder if there would be a way to adjust for that since the next measure deals with the volume at each center to make sure that the mortality is looked at with the volume in mind. But I think we have all the information at this point.
Yeah, I think that's really the intent of I mean, these measures should really be looked at as a pair.
Yes, absolutely.
And I will tell you that at the time they were endorsed, that is precisely the recommendation that was made by the committee at that time and is included in the report that they should be reported as a pair.
Mm-hmm. Now, does anybody have any insight in terms of, you know, is this a group of patients, for example, that has a high readmission and subsequent mortality or a high rate of hospital transfer such that using inpatient deaths is going to be a good measure as opposed to, for example, looking at 30-day mortality?
I don't, but I think that's a very good point, and perhaps that could be another note that's brought up during our meeting, because that brings up a very good point as far as, I mean, this is going to be a higher acuity group of patients, and probably looking at 30-day mortality is going to be quite valuable.
Mm-hmm. So I can snoop around and, you know, see if I can find any figures to help support that one way or the other. Maybe a total non-issue, but I think it's something that warrants at least looking into.
Yeah, and will the measure developers from ARC be able to speak to that as well? This is Arden talking.
Yes, they should be able to speak to that, and I suspect that a note will go back to them after.
Okay,
that.
Great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue, the way it's done is very easy because the data can be administratively collected. 30-day follow-up requires, you know, phone calls, letters, other modes of follow-up.
Right, and the ACS NISQIP would be a nice platform for that, except that they only collect about 20% of data. So potentially could miss 80% of esophageal cancer cases.
Right, and for a low-volume procedure, then suddenly your statistics are impaired.
Yes, absolutely.
Anything you wanted to call out with respect to the individual criteria?
Excuse me?
Is there anything you wanted to call out and discuss in particular related to the individual criteria for this measure?
No, they seem to be very, I mean, it's a very straightforward administrative collection.
We want to go ahead and talk about the next one. We're on the same topic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's simply looking, I mean, everything's exactly the same. It's simply looking at hospital volume for this same set of CPT codes, so you can get both a numerator and a denominator.
Yeah. This is Arden. I think this is a much more robust quality indicator, volume, than mortality.
Well, this is Jim Carpenter, and I was the outlier on this one, figuring that, but I really didn't think of the real low-volume centers and these at individual levels. I think that's a good point. You know, in many ways, the volume is a proxy for mortality. That's how this was somewhat justified, I thought, in the area there. So that's why I think by itself, unless you think this is statistically better than mortality because it's so typically linked, but all by itself, it didn't seem to be as robust as the mortality.
You know, let me modify. This is Arden again. Let me modify what I'm saying with that. If we're talking about aggregate mortality, then mortality is really what it's all about. And so I agree that mortality is more meaningful than volume itself. But if this is to be applied to individual hospitals, I think that volume at that level will be more predictive of mortality over time. And when I say over time, I mean like a 10-year stretch or something that would be inconceivable to measure, you know, as individual measures. So I think volume would be more predictive for individual hospitals of mortality over a long period of time. But mortality itself, if it's measured in aggregate, is more linked to mortality. So that's what I'm trying to just clarify. If this is being measured on annually, it may not be, if mortality is measured annually at the individual hospital level, it won't be quite as useful as volume.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me.
Right. And obviously, I mean, we know from a lot of the NISQIP data, even if you look at, quote, high-volume hospitals or large hospitals, that there's significant variability in their outcomes.
Right.
So I was the real outlier in that one, and I certainly understand that better now with your comments. So I don't need to – I'm not trying to – take a stand on that. I think that makes more sense.
Okay, can we move on to the next one?
I'll get to the heart.
Yes, Dennis Rivenberg, have you joined? Do you want to go ahead and talk about this one together? or do you want to skip to the next one and come back?
Right, let's skip and then come back.
Okay. So, James Carpenter.
Okay. I don't know how much I prepared because I didn't know what we were doing for this conference call, but this indicator is part of a big group of blood management indicators that we're going to go through, and some of them are quite parallel. This is the first of three that are blood cell transfusion indication. The other is plasma, and the other is platelets, and they're all parallel. Probably why blood cell transfusion is a little more straightforward and maybe a model for how we look at the other ones. And the proposed measure is for all patients who, let me get it in front of me here, who have blood transfusions with a few exceptions. And to meet the criteria as being having this done, you have to both have a hematocrit done before the transfusion. I believe it's 24 hours. And a clinical indication documented somewhere prior to the transfusion. I don't know if it's prior, but clinical indication documented somewhere for each unit of blood that's being transfused. And it was tested on a population with a commission or a tool from the Joint Commission. All these were tested with the same tool that was provided to us in, to a degree, and then put it back. So the justification for this is that our blood cell transfusions in general are frequently overused and sometimes misused, and it's in a common procedure. It's a procedure with potential high risk and high cost. Therefore, it's important, and so that's a justification for doing this, and the idea that you should have both a pre-transfusion measure of red blood cells and a indication documented for proceeding with transfusion. Criteria to meet this goal. So I didn't print out my whole, all the information that was provided, but hopefully most of you looked through that. We can look through the sort of individual groups here, as I think there's agreement in some areas and disagreement in other areas. I think everybody agrees that this is an important problem. And the rationale for the part two portion was pretty well agreed to. I think there's not clarity in my mind about what is a documented indication in the medical record. That was where one of the things I struggled with trying to find in the Joint Commission tool and otherwise what were the acceptable findings for demonstrating a indication in the medical record for transfusion. Obviously, a hematocrit's easy to find, but what are the acceptable records that would qualify for an indication, documented indication for transfusion? I think that's one of the biggest problems for that. Finding that, it's not typically electronically findable. That's where the confusion and problems with this show up. So going through this, I think most people actually weren't that far off in whether these things were met or not. Some disagreement about whether it's recommended at the end. But you know, my feeling is, I think it's an important problem. I think this is in some way to document that a transfusion was indicated is an appropriate thing to try to figure out, an important thing to figure out. I didn't think this tool met the criteria to make it usable, especially in defining and finding out what a documented indication in the medical record was. So that was so I think that's the biggest area of problem for this thing. There are other areas that are difficult and challenging: operating room transfusions, active bleeding, and other unique settings. But in the standard patient care areas, documenting and determining what's an acceptable documentation for transfusion is can be problematic. And it would require, basically, I've been through it with our staff here, it would require hospitals establishing a new tool that would be used, a former tool that would require documentation of prior to transfusion.
James, this is Arden. I have a question for you about this. Did you find the exclusions, for example, say a trauma patient comes into the trauma bay bleeding profusely, would that patient be excluded from needing to have these things documented in the chart?
The exclusions were well defined. It was unclear to me what all the exclusions were. I don't have it up in front of me, but I thought that would.
Okay. In my report here, it says denominator exclusions, none, but I'm thinking that there must have been a list of exclusions someplace that was more than just none. Anybody else aware of that?
The Joint Commission want to comment on exclusions for this criteria?
Harriet?
Maybe we can just record that for further discussion at the when we meet in person as well. I had a couple of other questions as well. Just like you, James, I was concerned about where the clinical indication for need for transfusion would be recorded, whether it would be in a chart note that somebody would have to search the chart for, which I think is not feasible, or whether it would be recorded in the orders, which also may be really cumbersome for hospitals to search. And then my last question was, what is an episode of care? Is it the 24-hour period before the transfusion, or is it the whole duration of the hospitalization? That was unclear to me as well. And then for each bag of blood, say somebody is transfused with 2 units, do they need to have, is it possible that a hospital would be dinged for not obtaining 2 hematocrits? Would 1 hematocrit or hemoglobin suffice if they're given 2 bags of blood or 3 bags of blood? Do they need to have this repetitively documented?
I mean, I think without active bleeding, the guidelines, most recommended guidelines are that after 1 unit is given, a hematocrit is rechecked. I think that's not unreasonable, and I think that's the problem. That's one of the behaviors that this is hoping to curb is a hematocrit at a certain level and someone orders multiple units of blood without rechecking an hematocrit in between.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess I just want for that to be really explicit. I agree with you, and I also agree about the importance of this measure. I think it's very important. I agree it's a common procedure, not often thought of as a procedure, but a very common procedure, and clearly we can do better.
I think the requirement for a hematocrit before each transfusion is not unreasonable. I mean, that would be but reasonable, but the specific documentation of an indication is certainly not how things are practiced right now.
Mm-hmm.
would require a significant change in practice, and would that by itself improve quality of care? I don't think so. I think from my perspective, requiring hematocrit could improve quality of care, especially for multiple units being given without rechecking. But requiring a documentation, if hematocrit is below a triggering level, to have to document that in the medical record to meet a quality measure when it's below a institutional guideline or accepted guidelines for transfusion, I think is not going to improve quality. It's just going to improve the workload.
Right. Improve or increase. I agree with you. I think potentially one exception could be trauma patients. Say you've got a kid who's had his vertebral arteries lacerated and
yes, no, they
bleeding out, you know.
Exclusions.
Yeah.
Actually, the exclusions are not even listed. So I think maybe that just didn't get done. I sort of, that was my impression, is that they meant you couldn't do this without having some exclusions.
Right.
Yeah, and the exclusion weren't actually included in the subsequent transfusion measures as well, and that's definitely an area of weakness that needs to be addressed with all three of these.
Those are all the comments that I have.
Hi, Alan Superstein here. You know, clearly one of the positive ulterior motives is to try to get, you know, hospitals to identify and enforce best practices for transfusion, and I think this goes a long way towards it. I think, you know, some of the little detailed issues would be worked out in the documentation. For example, somebody has a, you know, hematocrit of 15, giving a couple units, well, you can justify starting with a couple before you check, and obviously that would be, you know, like many of the measures, as long as there is clinical documentation, then you've met the standards. And obviously your point is very good. I think there needs to be a little more direction in terms of what is considered appropriate documentation. The other, I think the other issue, too, and just point out in some of the supporting literature, is despite there being some best practices out there, in practice there's great variability from institution to institution in terms of their blood utilization.
Yeah, I think you're right, and it certainly is justified to try to address that. And I think they're also right in try not to put specific numbers or targets in, probably, because the clinical scenario is so variable. And
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the point is not to be prescriptive to say that, you know, it's a crit of 28 versus a crit of 26, but simply that the clinician has considered it before giving the unit. So I agree. I think it's unrealistic to be prescriptive from a numerical point of view, et cetera, but simply, you know, requiring documentation that the clinician felt that it was appropriate.
I think that's why it becomes so important to better understand where the indications need to be documented, because if, you know, if we're looking at exceptions like this where it's not going to be as easy as pulling up that a lab test was done prior to transfusion, if people could actually write in what the reason was for not doing an additional lab test, which again would make sense if you're starting with such a low crit, then we got to think about how that data would be abstracted. And so, again, I think it makes it more important to understand how is this supposed to be documented and then abstracted.
So we would want for the developers to potentially address that question as well in our in-person steering committee meeting.
So I have a sort of a question about how this group interacts with developers. So my understanding was these measures were our goal, our charge was either to accept them or not accept them. And that rewriting them, for example, or changing them, recommending new ways to do it, wasn't a particular part of our goal or charge. Is that?
This is Arden. I would say that definitely rewriting them is not part of our charge. But I think that it is certainly within bounds to ask for them to go find out more information or potentially to do more work on it, or recommending to NQF that they in with whatever language NQF uses, that they seek more data about a particular topic. So I agree with you. Our charge is to discuss it and give an opinion. But part of that can be our sort of thoughtful request for more information or for the measure to be developed along a certain line.
And it's Melinda, just to add to what you just said, in addition to being able to come to a conclusion about whether or not the measure meets the criteria such that it would be eligible for consideration for endorsement, if the group feels that there is something that keeps it from meeting criteria, and that something could be added to the measure, you will have an opportunity also to say, we would find this meeting the criteria and acceptable for endorsement under certain conditions, which could then go back to the developer in terms of their interest and openness and ability to make changes that would make it acceptable for endorsement.
So I thought from our discussion, most people thought this was important. There was something here. We either need more information or it needs to be modified. When I look at whether this should be recommended or not, the group is almost all, yes, it should be recommended. So there's a little...
Those are just our preliminary scores.
Okay. I mean, we're all
right.
Went through that tool. I'm not sure we all knew how it all needed to be used, but I'm just...
Well, I think we all agree with the concept of what's trying to be done. I think the part that we need more information on is how it's going to be done. But I think this is one of those measures where, theoretically, everyone's on board with making sure that we're appropriately transfusing patients.
When we discussed this with the experts with these tools there, can we ask them more specifically about what is acceptable, for example, of a chart documentation of a transfusion?
We shouldn't ask them what's acceptable, but we should ask them what they had in mind. Because we're the ones who are determining whether or not it's acceptable.
What's acceptable,
yeah,
for meeting the criteria as they have proposed it.
Right. So when they tell us what they had in mind, then we'll sort of decide amongst ourselves if we think that's acceptable. But I hope I'm not sort of putting too fine a point on it.
I understand exactly what you mean.
Okay. Is it okay to move on?
If the group is ready to move on, absolutely move along.
All right, let's see.
So 1532, I'll ask again, is Dennis on the line? I thought we should go on to 1532.
Was that Nassim or was that Dennis?
Yeah. Actually evaluated those.
Okay.
So this actually follows very nicely from the conversation that we just had about transfusion of packed red blood cells. The two measures that come up after that are about transfusion of plasma cells and transfusion of platelets. So we can split them up and talk about them separately, although to a great degree I think they have the strengths and the weaknesses of the red blood cell group. So for the 32 measure, it looks at the percentage of transfused plasma cells that actually have a PTN INR checked prior to transfusion, as well as making sure that the indication is documented. Again, obviously, as far as the impact of this, it's going to be a high-impact measure, considering how many units of plasma are transfused, as far as the adverse events with transfusion reactions and acute lung injury. That's been well documented. But again, the weaknesses that I saw in this were some of what we discussed, and the two main ones that I think I mentioned in my evaluation was that, again, we don't have a clear set of indications, and this is an opportunity where not only could we make sure that clinicians are documenting the appropriate indications, but it could also be a teaching tool so that clinicians know what the appropriate indications are, and perhaps standardizing that to some extent would be helpful both for the purposes of providing care and for purposes of abstraction. And then secondly, I did have concerns, again, both about this measure and the next one as far as the challenge that it poses for institutions that don't have electronic health records, and the fact that a lot of this needs to be abstracted by hand. And when it comes to the indications, it can be highly variable as far as the location of this, and it can become very cumbersome. So those are the main points that I brought up with those. Looking at how we evaluated this measure, again, I overall see a lot of consistency in our evaluation. So I'll just open it up to discussion at this point.
This is even a step more challenging than, I mean, both these next two, than red blood cells in terms of what are acceptable indications. I know we're not trying to define what acceptable indications are, and really the measure has only to do with whether an indication was documented or not, whether it was a correct indication. But it's one step more difficult than the red blood cell problem. So I think that's the biggest problem I have, and it's not so straightforward, I don't think, that between every unit at PT, you know, the COAGs need to be checked between every unit.
Between units would be unreasonable.
It's clearly been recommended in red blood cell transfusions, except for exceptional cases of very low hematocrits or rapid bleeding in with plasma and platelets. I'm not sure that is an accepted requirement for improved care.
So I think, again, one point that needs to be clarified is the frequency with which you would need to have a check. And, again, you're absolutely right that for these two measures, this is not something that we would need to do, or we would be required to do it between units.
I think as was written, it was for every unit is a separate event.
It was in the document. That's my understanding.
Up to what? Three per patient? Is that how they were?
I thought they said four, but then I saw three somewhere else, so I wasn't quite sure.
So maybe they can clarify that as well. I really agree with everything that you guys, this is Arden, I really agree with everything that you guys have said regarding 1532 and 1539. And I do think it's a little bit more complicated than the red blood cell transfusion as well. So we can request clarity from the developer on this one as well.
Again, I know we kind of did the majority of our discussions with the red blood cells, but anything else that that you have thought about specifically for these? Again, I just kind of have to echo some of our previous discussions with both this one and the platelet transfusion.
I don't have anything. This is Arden. I don't have anything more to add. I do think that these things are really important, and your point about the burden on the hospitals and searching through the charts is a really important point, just as for the red blood cells.
Perfect. Well, I've made notes of that to make sure that we discuss that during our in-person meeting.
Okay. Anybody object to moving on to 1541? Let's keep going then.
That's one I'm supposed to do.
Okay.
So this, sure I know that's what this is. This is documenting that the patient's getting the right blood, basically, right?
Right.
Right of blood document. So this is basically whether for each unit of red blood cells, plasma, or platelets, that the two identifiers are used to make sure that the blood is being given to the right blood is being given to the right patient.
I have to say, I'm surprised that this is a new candidate measure. I thought that this was routinely done.
Well, I think it is routinely done. The question is it routinely
documented
and reported? And I think that was my concerns were this. Obviously, if this happens, it's a huge problem. I apologize because I wasn't as prepared for that. Is there a gap, a significant gap in this measure that reporting it and following it would attempt to improve?
Alan here. That was my exact question. I mean, this seems to be so standard. The question is this a problem that requires extra energy and effort and documentation to report, or is this already done with such a high level of compliance that efforts are best placed at following other quality metrics?
Right. That was my – obviously everyone thinks it should be done. I'm just trying to go through where they're – Well, I think the question is in the test where these things were all tested, and basically they're all tested together, so there's a lot of basically repeat. The question is whether they could document that this was actually done. So I'm not sure that that's the same as if finding a gap in the documentation, is that really finding a gap in the actual performance of this activity.
Right. The only data supporting an issue in the United States is the VA study that they cited with 100 individual root cause analysis reports between 2000 and 2003. 100 for all of the blood transfusions that are given in the VA system annually. It's actually not that many.
Yeah, they don't have a percentage. In their extraction and testing this, the overall rate they found of this being documented was 77%. With standard deviation of 20%. So I don't think we would expect that it's only being done 80% of the time. It's just not being documented 80% of the time.
Right.
So I think maybe the impetus is on them to prove that this is really a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
agree with that.
It's a simple thing. It's very easy to measure. You can produce lots of reports, but the question is, if it's not, if it ain't broke, why keep documenting it? And I think almost all hospitals have very rigid protocols for, two providers identifying the patient, signing off on every unit. I don't know of a place that doesn't have a fairly rigid process in place.
Right. I guess that what we'd need is some demonstration that there are any hospitals that don't have that rigid process in place. maybe the developers can think about that one and see if they can make any comments about it. Let's see, I'm trying to figure out who the developers are here. Is this also ARC?
All these
joint
all
commission?
Product measures are joint commission.
Okay, joint commission, okay.
With the package.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were actually others that were proposed that are not in this ones we're reviewing.
Okay.
Documentation I've seen on.
All right. I think we're, it seems to me that we're in agreement that there's a question about whether there's a gap in quality for that one. Are there any other issues with this measure that we should discuss? Anybody have anything else?
Otherwise, it's pretty straightforward.
Right. And obviously very important.
It may, if it was, I mean, one way to think about these is, okay, well, if it was implemented, what would that mean?
Right.
I mean,
like what would the resources?
That have to be better documented.
Right.
Done as the way it's always done, and now it has to be recorded that it was done. So it wouldn't be a huge burden to do that, although extracting that would be manual, I think. Seeing documentation.
All right. Is there anything else that anybody wants to add to the discussion about 1541? And is Dennis on the line? Maybe we could table 1542 for now and move on to 1547. Anybody object to that? James, I think you're on again.
47 is preemptive blood type screening done prior to surgery for selected procedures where blood is commonly used. Orthopedic procedures, and that would obviously be fairly easy to measure. It probably has a reasonable impact and importance. Again, I don't know what the gap is in what's not being done. According to their extraction, what they found is the overall rate for hospitals was 92%. Patient of 21, median of 98%. Outliers in that. I think it's good practice. It makes sense. It'd be reasonably easy to determine whether this was being done. It's a limited number of diagnoses. So it comes down to whether there, in my mind, whether there was enough of a gap to make it, measuring it useful, impactful. These documents are so huge, it's hard. I'm trying to pull up what the actual procedures were. I don't remember them off the top of my head.
What the actual orthopedic procedures were and so forth?
Oh, I mean, it was sort of joint replacements and those are the ones.
Yeah, cardiac procedures, hysterectomy.
Yeah.
Joint procedures.
I wasn't sure what the data was for the hysterectomies. I saw the data, the other three. Did anyone come across why hysterectomies were included in that?
I have a personal, this is Arden, I have a personal, I think I need to not be part of the hysterectomy discussion. My college roommate actually died because she bled out during a hysterectomy, if you can believe that. in the U.S. So I don't think I should be part of that discussion.
I don't know what the risk for needing transfusions and hysterectomy is.
It's got to be small, but what happens?
Now, I mean, all they're asking for is a type and screen.
Right.
And again, you know, this is one of these measures where, you know, for many types of operations, they're protocol preoperative order sets, and the things like this are standardly done. And with the, and, you know, the question then is, because it is something that is very standard in many institutions, are we really going to move the quality needle by implementing something like this?
Right.
Yeah.
Or, again, are efforts better spent focusing on something else?
So maybe we need more information about whether there's a gap.
You know, people showing up to the operating room for their heart bypass and not having a screen and having antibodies and having a problem from that or not. I mean, that's a... it's in my experience, that's a exceedingly rare event.
Well, we should. They may have more information, or try to find. I mean, some of that I can look into before see how common that is.
Right. I think that the developer, I think that our role is to ask the developer to provide all of the data that they can find about it instead of increasing the workload of the committee beyond trying to assess the measure itself. I don't think that we should necessarily do the lit searches unless you feel very compelled to.
So we could come away with a recommendation. If there's enough evidence that this is a performance gap, then it would be more appropriately encouraged, endorsement encouraged.
All right. Any other items with this particular measure? Should we go back and do the two that Dennis was in charge of, just sort of talk them over as a group then? Melinda or Alexis, do you want to
Sure. Yes, the group, it should, to the extent that it would be useful to you in preparing for the steering committee meeting to have that conversation about the two, yes, do go back and take a look at those. And I, let me just go back. Since Dennis is not on the call, if there's a member of the group who feels comfortable in leading that discussion, that would be great. If not, then I think if you just look across and look across at the ratings and bring forward any of your particular thoughts as you were evaluating the measure. Arden, if that's okay with you.
Sure, absolutely.
Oh, Alan here. I can make a couple comments. I mean, this really has two components. I mean, it has the consent part of it, and then it has the educational component. The consent's an easy piece of paper to get from a chart. The, you know, what constitutes acceptable educational component is a little bit more difficult to do. And, you know, the question is, once the patient gets informed consent, are they really going to say no to a transfusion, or is this really to help educate the healthcare provider or kind of prevent a little barrier for the healthcare provider in terms of ordering transfusions without thinking about it? My other, you know, question about the measure had to do with what the current standards are that are in place. Specifically, I know the Joint Commission has standards for for this.
Well, this is Jim Carpenter. I agree with both those points. And one question was what constitutes acceptable consent? And many consents for transfusions are check boxes on a procedural consent. Sent a procedure with blood, and the blood box is checked as consent for transfusion. And really, it's a consent for the procedure that's being done. And beyond that, I'm not aware of the requirements for a patient signing a consent before a transfusion. Not related to the procedure like that.
Do you mean if they weren't getting a procedure for them to sign a consent?
Yeah, I don't know how to do that.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
So living on the medicine side of it, definitely. And I actually thought that was also mandated by law, that all transfusions that occur, so, for example, if you have a GI bleeder that comes in, you do need to actually have them sign a consent, and then they actually get an educational packet. Now, I'm really interested to see, because I thought that was actually standard and mandated. I'm actually interested to see where that's coming from, and I can definitely look into that and see.
This is Arden. In my experience, it is just as I believe it was Jim who said, or maybe Alan, that it's just you just check a box on the standard consent form, and that's pretty much all there is to it with our surgical patients.
I think that what looking at this, reading through their documentation, there clearly is a gap in education. There clearly is education that is not taking place to the patient around transfusion. I don't think that anyone would dispute that. Educating a patient, I may be naive, but I don't think that there's evidence that impacts patient outcome. It may impact patient experience and their impression of why they got it and their satisfaction with that process, but that's not likely to affect patient outcome. At least it hasn't been demonstrated that there's, by adding a educational component, outcomes improved. Patient experience can be improved, I believe.
Well, I wonder if it's a piece of patient engagement, and to be honest, I don't know that literature very well, but in the same lines as communicating better with patients and letting them know what's going on so that they could then spot errors and be a participant in their care versus a recipient of care. Again, I don't know what the data is or if there is any data with this type of patient education material. But there definitely is if for cases where you actually talk to the patient about the procedure or about their plan, and then they're able to spot errors or be erroneously taken for a different procedure.
The other thing, this is Arden, the other thing I'd like to add to that is that when you talk about morbidity, mortality outcomes, I agree that education probably won't change that, but the other outcome that we're supposed to be keeping in mind is that patient-centeredness or sort of a quality of life outcome. So that may be affected. And I think that didn't they display some data saying that a large number of patients didn't understand why they had received a transfusion.
Yeah, no, I think they did a good job in demonstrating that was an opportunity or a gap.
Right.
Current practices. That part of it.
Then I think the other issue that was raised is how in the world is this going to be measured? And I think that that's a good question, because if chart searches are just not practical. So some sort of a note documenting the education in the chart that is not on a standard form is, of course, not practical for measuring.
Yeah, I do think that's one of the greatest weaknesses of this measure.
Okay. Anybody else have anything else on 1526? It sounds like they are saying basically stay tuned. When they talk about electronic sources under 4 feasibility, and they say that they are going to retool the specifications for retrieval from an electronic health record in January 2011. So it may be that we'll learn more about how that's supposed to be feasibly done in when they're present in our meeting.
I got the feeling, obviously these are new proposals, that they were not finished with some of these. For example, the exclusion criteria and some are not included. I don't know whether the steering, you know, interaction with the steering committee helps them fine-tune and finish these. Part of our goal is to help them.
Just by asking questions.
But
in the final analysis, you will be making recommendations regarding whether or not they should be endorsed as they've been submitted.
Right.
Or recommending endorsement on condition of certain things. And one of the things you'll probably be talking about in that context, just to take a look at the extent of pilot testing that was done in terms of whether or not that would meet the expectation of being fully tested and ready for implementation. You're going to look at 1542 now?
Yeah, let's move on to 1542. And again, Melinda or Alexis, do you want to jump start this?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Would you like to jump start this since Dennis is not available?
Just in terms of asking if those present, if anyone present is comfortable in going ahead and beginning a conversation about this measure, or those of you who have particular concerns or thoughts about it, to go ahead and register those.
Well, Alan here, I can make a few comments. Looks at the similar group of orthopedics, cardiac and hysterectomy elective surgical patients and requires that anemia evaluation be done preoperatively. From a logistics point of view, you know, one of the questions I had had to do with the 14 to 45 day screening time. And there are many of these elective procedures that may be seen and booked in less than 14 days, so that may not always be feasible. From a scientific point of view, obviously you want to know whether your patients are anemic. The question is, in how many of them, you know, is it due to underlying disease, and whether correction of the anemia preoperatively has any impact on outcome? So that was my clinical question about these, from, you know, in terms of being aware of whether your patient has anemia and trying to make measures to improve it may minimize the need for blood transfusion in that group. So that's clearly the value of this measure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I share your feeling about why the time frame. Why 14 days? Why that specific range? And is that really going to be impactful? I think what I read from them was that gives the physician time to address and improve and optimize patient surgery. That may very well be true, but you could have a patient that had a known low hematocrit 6 weeks beforehand, and you would want to know that they still needed the procedure, and you would want to know what it was before the procedure, but you might miss that 14-to-30-day window or 14-to-45-day window.
Yeah, I agree. Just logistically, I can just see running into a lot of problems with this, trying to pull it off in a practical manner. And the intent I see is very laudable.
Yeah, and I don't know what their, you know, how big a problem this is. I think this is pretty, you know, this and the type and screening is pretty standard protocol for those procedures. And we may ask them for evidence that this is, that measuring this and following this and potentially improving this would actually have an impact on care and outcome.
I really struggled with this measure from a clinical standpoint, and again, you know, mostly seeing internal medicine patients, you know, we get a lot of patients who have anemia of varying degrees for different reasons, and you know, I don't know how that necessarily translates for the surgical patients, but part of my concern was that we need to better define anemia. I mean, it can't just be a hemoglobin or a hematocrit that's below the normal range. A lot of times we get variability in patients' hemoglobins from day to day. Or you need to have trends for the anemia. Again, as it was mentioned before, there are patients who have had a low hematocrit for years, and that's just how their bone marrow functions. So just getting a single value is not really something that that is as beneficial, and you can really kind of get a big workup done, everything including a bone marrow biopsy. I'm not sure how useful that is in your assessment of how the patient is going to do during the surgery. As far as knowing severe degrees of anemia and looking at remedying that before they go for surgery, that makes good sense. But again, anemia has a very broad spectrum, and I just didn't feel like this measure defined that very well.
Right, I think it's such a low level. If it's, you can think of it as, should someone have a preoperative hematocrit?
Exactly, that's reasonable.
And I think
reasonable.
We all agree, yes, at some point they should have a preoperative hematocrit. This is just saying they should have a preoperative hematocrit, and it should be within this window of time. Probably all agree they should have a preoperative hematocrit. We may not agree on what the window of time is. They may need a lot more than that, I think is what you're saying. There's a lot more that goes into that. But as a minimum, is this a reasonable measure as a minimum to have before a major surgery where you might need transfusion? I think it is. I object primarily to the window of time, and whether this is really a problem to measure.
Right.
Measure something that's not a problem. Those are my only objections to this.
Okay. So those also, maybe the developer, I'm sure that they must have had something in mind when they chose the time span, and so it would be nice to know exactly what that was. Any other issues with this particular measure? Alexis, is there anything else that we should discuss in terms of the public comment or member comment?
Yes, we can now open the public participant lines to see if any NQF members or any members of the public have any comments to make. Ravi, are the lines open?
Yes, all lines are open.
Okay, is there anyone who would like to make a comment?
Including the developers.
Hi, this is Ann Watt from the Joint Commission, and we are the developers of the measures you discussed during the call. I just want you to know that we do have very detailed specifications for these measures, which we will be happy to share with you at the meeting on the 28th, and that I think we can address all of your questions. It was just rather unclear as to whether or not that was our role in this call this afternoon, but thank you for your feedback, and stay tuned. We look forward to talking with you further.
Is there anyone else who would like to comment? Okay, Melinda, I guess we can start off with next steps and the role of the designated lead at the in-person meeting.
Okay. And I would say, to in response to the comment that Ann just made, we really did not expect that the developers would come to this meeting prepared to respond to questions, knowing that you got rather late notice of the meeting and that the purpose of the full committee meeting is to be able to have everyone in the steering committee to be able to hear any questions and any responses. So it was fine that you did not have answers today, and it would have been fine for any answers that you did have to be presented. So not to be concerned about not being prepared today with the answers. That will occur on at the in-person meeting time. In terms of the in-person meeting, I'll repeat what I said a bit earlier. Each individual member who has led a discussion today about measures will be tapped to lead or to open the discussion, I should say, about those measures at the face-to-face meeting. And in opening that discussion, what we will look for you to do, because we will have the full steering committee and we will have the developers and we will have other NQF members in the public present, is that in introducing them, you give the measure number, you give the title and a brief description of the measure, summarize in a brief way what you've summarized today in terms of the ratings, your overall rationale or reasoning behind those ratings, any concerns that you have that you would like to have addressed, any differences among the group, and for this group, there really didn't sound like there were any significant differences in the way in which you viewed the measures. And all of that you'll be doing within a span of about 2 hours. So what that means is you will have to be as focused and have the discussion as tightly contained and on point as you possibly can, and you've done that well today, so it shouldn't be any problem whatsoever. The measures will be evaluated as you have looked at them in terms of the criteria. We will be using an electronic voting tool, not its maiden voyage. It will have been used a couple of times by the time we get to it. And we will have a demonstration of that at the executive session the morning of the first day. So you'll have an opportunity to see how that is going to work. The developers, as has been noted a few times, will be present. We expect that there will be people who have expertise in the development of the measures, knowing and understanding the information that goes behind the measures, the methodology, and be able to address all of your questions. There certainly is an opportunity, if all your questions cannot be addressed to your satisfaction, that would allow you to make a judgment about whether or not they meet the criteria, to have the developer have the opportunity to collect that information and bring it back. But to the extent that we're able to do so, the goal for the entire meeting is to be able to evaluate and make recommendations based on meeting criteria about moving the measures forward for endorsement as they stand. And as I said earlier, you do have an option of moving them forward with conditions if you feel like they are not strong enough as they are to move forward for endorsement. Any questions about the approach? You will get most of the information that we've talked about today. You'll get out in writing in a memorandum, and you will get a draft agenda. The one thing that I would say is we really will hold to the agenda once we get it out, which should be within the, well, probably either later today or early next week, and Alexis can tell us when she expects that will be. But we will be looking to hold to it because we have grouped the measures in a way that tries to put similar kinds of measures together, and we're making arrangements with developers to be there at specific times in order to be able to address questions. So we'll try to stay on track. This group of measures is likely, or right now it's scheduled in our draft that you'll be seeing soon, to be discussed on day one between approximately 3 to 5 in the afternoon.
So when you mentioned the two-hour window, that's to discuss this whole group of measures? That we're
correct.
Doing? So about maybe a little bit longer than we've spent on them today.
Yes.
Tremendous amount more.
Correct. And in that period of time, there will also be voting on the extent to which they meet the criteria. So it's pretty tight. Any other questions or comments? Your co-chairs for the committee are Dr. Morris and Dr. Torchiana. Their activities, in addition to providing their expertise across all of the work of the 2 days, will also be to keep the meeting focused on track and moving for you in order to bring out important points and in order to move it expeditiously forward. Arden, is there anything you'd want to add to that? You've certainly done some of this work before.
I don't really have anything else to add. I guess I just I think that it was a pretty high-quality discussion today, and I really appreciate everybody's engagement.
From among the group, any questions about what to expect at the meeting, anything that you need to make you feel more confident that you have the tools to go into it?
I have a question about our input to measures from the other work groups. What is that? Does everybody give input to all the measures? And this work group has spent more time on these few measures and will bring it forward and potentially make a recommendation or initiate the discussion, but it's the entire group that continues the discussion and makes the vote?
That is correct. The entire group is expected to vote on the criteria for each and every measure.
So we should all spend time on the other measures.
Yes.
More familiar with those as well. Okay.
Yes. Anything else? Alexis, anything else that you want to add?
Yes, I'd just like to point out Benita from NQF staff, she sent out a logistics memo on Monday, February 7th. If you did not receive that memo, please let me know. Please fax her the lodging request form. Please fill that out and fax it back to her by next Friday, February 18th, so that we can make sure that we have your hotel arrangement. And as Melinda said, we will be getting you an agenda as well as instructions for the in-person meeting, and that will go out to you via email early next week.
And please do plan to come at the start of the meeting on the 28th for the executive session, because that'll be an opportunity to see a demo of this voting tool and to get any last questions that you might have and get any bit of instruction that that the co-chairs might want to ask of you going into the meeting. So we shall see you bright and early, and we will serve you continental breakfast as an enticement. If there's not anything else, then we can sign off, and thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you much.